Maybe we're on page 118.
B3, if you're using the article. We're on 118, Kuf Yud Chet Bet, 118B. Lots of wonderful tales of the rabbis here and further teachings about Shabbat. So, on the left-hand side, we start with Rabbi Yossi. The Gemara is going to cite a personal statement of Rabbi Yossi. Ama Rabbi Yossi. Rabbi Yossi says the following. Hamesh bilot ba'alti. I performed 5 conjugal acts. 5 marital acts. Now why the discussion of Rabbi Yossi here is situated in Shabbat about marital acts is because there's already a tradition that on Friday night particularly, on Shabbat, it is a time to make zivug. It is a time to make a coupling with one's spouse. Or, it's taking the metaphorical understanding or traditional understanding or mystical understanding of Shabbat being the kala, being the bride of Israel, and that the Jewish people, Am Yisrael, is marrying kala, the bride, which is Shabbat, to create a unity which brings divinity into the world, which is encountered in our Gemara in just a few paragraphs down the line. We're going to have a reference to this and a discussion of this. But it is within that kind of context that Rabbi Yossi's statement is being made. But particularly that rabbis are interested in terms of the rabbinic culture of telling you about sometimes origin stories, hagiography. We know embedded in the Gemara is a little bit of that literary modality. Hagiography is a feature of ancient literature. Origin stories are among those that make their way in sometimes shorter and sometimes longer passages in the Gemara. And they're wonderful. And we're going to turn our attention to this one and then to some others throughout the discussion tonight. So Rabbi Yossi says, I had 5 times that I had these marital acts. Natati chamisha arazim b'Yisrael. And I sowed the seeds for 5 cedars within the Jewish people. What are the cedars? The rabbis who are really profoundly impactful among the Jewish people are called arazim. They're called cedars. Right? So, anybody who knows the Shabbat davening and knows Mizmor Shir L'Yom HaShabbat, Tzadik Katamar Yifrach, and this is in this book of Psalms, a tzaddik, a righteous person, like a palm, date palm, will arise in Israel, Keres Balvanan Yiske, and like a cedar of Lebanon, will flourish. And so, the cedar tree is used as the metaphor here, or used as the symbol of a strong, strong rav in Israel. And being that you have this strong rabbis, collection of 5 rabbis that are going to come now for the 5 acts of marital zivug, the coupling that happened. And so he says, the Gemara identifies Rabbi Yossi's sons. Uman Inun, and who are these 5 rabbis, 5 cedars within the Jewish people? Rabbi Yishmael, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Halafta, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Av Tilas, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Menachem, Rabbi Yossi. They are as follows. Rabbi Yishmael, Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Halafta, Rabbi Av Tilas, and Rabbi Menachem. 5 rabbis did these 5 times that he lay with his wife were born. So the Gemara is going to ask now, V'ha'ika Vardimas? But there is yet another son of Rabbi Yossi. It's Vardimas.
That's the black cedar.
Oh, wait a minute. The Gemara answers. Hainu Vardimas, Hainu Menachem. Vardimas is really the one we called Menachem. They're the same. His true name is Menachem. V'amai Karele Vardimas. And so why do they call him Vardimas? Why do they have this other name? Shepanav domin leverid, that his face resembled a rose. The word verid is a rose. Like right. It means the color of a rose. So, in this sense, he had a rosy complexion, as it's written on the bottom. The Gemara expresses surprise at Rabbi Yossi's statement that he performed only 5 marital acts, though. Listen to this. Wait a minute. You only had sex with your wife 5 times. L'meinu de Rabbi Yossi mitzvah ona lo kiyem. It's possible to stay here, since we know that there's a mitzvah of ona. It's a requirement within Jewish law that a person have relations with his wife. And you're saying that he could get away with having only 5 times these relations? Especially with what we know about Talmidei Chachamim. Especially with what we know about sages and this obligation they have. Eila Ema, rather, this is what it's meant. Chamesh bi'ilot ba'alti v'shaniti. On 5 occasions, I performed a marital act, and then I repeated it. In other words, 5 occasions, in terms of the sexual act that we performed, we had sex, there was the copulation, and I went, and then we did it a second time. And so, right, you get it. And they're not afraid to talk about it. Oh, so is it too much information? Okay, so this is exactly my point. Let's talk about the supplemental material already, because how could you come here and not have supplemental material? How could you say too much information? Because it's not too much information according to the rabbis in lots of different ways. I'm going to first start you off with... Interestingly enough, if I was writing the footnotes in the Art School Gemara, I would have included in footnote 40 the following. And this is just an interesting note sometimes as we look at, again, translations and what's included. How many times does the Art School Gemara include a reference to another passage in the Gemara or the Mishnah and give you the texts that you ought to go look at in that? Here, I think they weren't included because it doesn't want to so much divert your attention to this matter. I think that there's something going on here. Meanwhile, if I was writing footnote 40, I would have included see Ketubot Samech Aleph Bet.
We previously did this one.
You previously did it. Wow. Wonderful. So you're going to have a Chazarah. You're going to have a. You're going to return to the text. So.
We'll do it again.
What Barry came for a second time.
All right, guys.
This is why maybe we shouldn't record the class. Okay, so where we are is this. I didn't bring you a Gemara, Samech Aleph Amud Bet. What I did is I brought you the Mishnah. The Mishnah to which really this is referring, that we should have in our minds as we read this passage and try to understand the Gemara's Kasha. What was the Gemara's Kasha? You're telling me it could have been only 5 times. How could possibly there be a statement in the Gemara that he did this only 5 times? Because we know that he has the mitzvah of doing ona, which is that he has an obligation to provide for conjugal relations. How do we know that? Look at Mishnah Vav, left side of the page where I have the Magen David. Hamadir et ishto mitashmisha mita. If one put his wife under a vow to have no connubial intercourse, in other words, there was going to be no sexual relations, the school of Shammai say, Beit Shammai omrim shtei shabbatot, he can do it for 2 weeks. But Beit Hillel says it can be for only 1 week, and then what, she has grounds for divorce, and she can demand the get, and she can say, sorry, this is not right. Because the original contract called for the fact that he should have, that she has the right to conjugal relations, that he has responsibility. Now, goes into a little bit of a discussion. Who has what kind of responsibility when it comes to conjugal relations? Hatamidim, the sages, people who are students of the rabbis and the rabbis, Yotzin, Latalmud Torah, Shelo Bereshut, Shloshim Yom. Even if a sage does not have permission, he may go and study for 1 month and thusly not provide any type of relationship like this. and be still okay, is she still okay? In other words, she has no grounds upon which to file for divorce. Ha-po'alim Shabbat Echad. Laborers for 1 week. Ha-onah ha-amurah v'torah. The time for marital duties enjoined in the law are, enjoined in the Torah, ha-tayalim b'chol yom. For men of independent means, every day they have the responsibility. A woman can demand it. Ha-po'alim shtayim b'shabbat. The workmen, twice weekly she can demand it. Ha-chamarim achat b'shabbat. For donkey drivers, once a week. Ha-gamalim, for camel drivers, achat l'shloshim yom, 1 in 30 days.
Yeah.
Why? Because a camel can go a lot farther than a donkey. Ha-safanim achat l'shisha chodeshim. And sailors, once every 6 months. Divrei Rabbi Eliezer. This is the opinion of Rabbi Eliezer. So you see that already the Mishnah really does deal with the issue of conjugal relations. And so the notion here that he goes back and does it twice is written in Eruvin, that if you want to have male children, you do such a sex act. And the rabbis in many places in the Gemara are not afraid of defining and talking about sex. And so when it comes to talking with young couples, right, and they're coming to the rabbi and they're going to have their chuppah in just a couple of weeks, one of the areas you talk about is physical relations. And you bring out every time in the Gemara, the rabbis are actually talking about how many times in one night and what's the position one ought to do it with and this way and that way. And you realize that the discussions of such things, especially on a Shabbat night, where that's the oneg is part of the delight that's called Shabbat within the context of our chapter, that this is a very real part of our heritage. And that when you sign a ketubah, if there's anything that's kind of an exciting part of the ketubah, it's the rights that were promised each other, especially if you're going to use, whether you're using traditional language or you're using egalitarian language, that it's either entirely one gives the other such rights, or they can each drag one another to the Beitin. But the rabbis were not fearful of entering these matters, and they were asking questions concerning these matters. And in the next part of it, you'll even see that they're going to get into a discussion about the male member. Next statement. Amar Rabbi Yossi, Miyamei lo kariti li'ishti ishti. I didn't call my wife, ishti. I didn't use that terminology. Ulishori shori, or my ox. Ela, what did I call my wife? Ela ishti beiti. I called my wife my home. I referred to her as the essential pillar of all that the home was about. And thusly, to build a home in Israel, Bayit Ne'eman B'Yisrael, is what we hope for in the circumcision ceremony. And that word Bayit, when it comes into liturgical terms, is that it's really kind of the metonym, in this case, a symbol that's not used entirely in its kind of even physical way, but the notion of a house being built, that you should have a family, that you with whom you have procreation, because the rabbinic culture is thinking about the woman within the household of Israel, Allah, Shabbat, and making such ritual. It's also thinking about her as the one who is the provider in this way to have a family in Israel, to bear children to the world. And then Lishorish Sadi and the ox my field. Again, taking the whole kind of conceptual notion. I call my ox my ox? No, I don't call my ox my ox. I understand that the ox is really central to the entire agricultural project that I am engaged in so that I can feed my family, make a living, progress society within the notion that the agricultural endeavors that we have within Israel include Peah, include leaving the corners of the field, include tzedakah, and so I have conceptually a whole understanding of what the shore is. And then he says, and Rabbi Yossi says, Miyamai lo nistakalti b'milashali. And in all my days I've never gazed at my circumcised member. So what do you do with this? So Rashi says that it's snuta, it's modesty. Straight up, that he's interested in being a modest soul. Hey, I guess he trusts the oil. And the Gemara asks, Amy? Really? I told you I love the Amy. I mean, that's like the best Gemara challenge. Like, so-and-so says, so-and-so, Amy? Really? The ha'amru le'la rabbi, but they said to Rebbe, my tam, akaru l'chara benu akadosh, why do they call Rebbe our holy teacher? Amar lahu, he said to them, mimai loni stakalti b'milashili, because I never looked at my circumcised member. Now, if it's true about Rebbe, that he called Rebbe akadosh, why don't they call him Rabbi Yossi HaKadosh, if he does the same kind of behavior, that he doesn't look down there at his circumcised member? Gemara explains this problem. But Rabbi Milta Achariti Havabe, there was another modest habit practiced by Rebbe. What was the other modest practice? Shelo Hichnis Yado Tacharav Neto, that he did not place his hand below the level of his belt, and for this reason, that's why he's the Rabbi HaKadosh. Now, this has become manifest in many, many circles, a la the Hasidic world. That's right. So you have what's called a gartel. And that band that you see certain people pray with, that has tassels on both sides, that's wrapped around, you start it by wrapping this way, it comes around, has two tassels here, there's a tuck under and a tuck over, and you wear two gartels. This is what separates the lower half, the Mila and the mean, Kli HaMin, the sex organ, and the bottom half, which is gufani, it's bodily, from the ruchani, from the nishmati, from the soulful and the spiritual. And some say it's demochin, some say it's between the mind, which is the ultimate mystico mode, the mystical mode of Jewish pursuits of God, and the Jewish pursuit of God, which is the corporeal. And so this has been written a lot about in Hasidic culture. It became most prevalent as it was codified into the Shulchan Aruch Arav. That's the Baal HaTanya, the first Lubavitcher rabbi's code of Jewish law. It also at the time is being used in cloisters around the Kabbalistic world that mimic this kind of separation in a physical way with a certain prayer garment. And for that matter, some people who are non-Hasidic, who either grew up in it and still have it, they kind of use this again in prayer moments, or you'll see that someone has a little bit of a Hasidic minhag that they pray with, and sometimes even in a standard kind of Ashkenazic shul, be a couple of people wearing a gartel, and they'll have these black kind of belts that they put on in order to make this kind of separation. This kind of keeping away from looking at your circumcised member, and this trope of knowing that it's not as kadosh as if you would not look upon it, and not as holy as if you would steer yourself clear from thinking about it, from looking at it, from engaging in, you know, who knows what, touching, particularly as the Torah says, to spill your zera, to spill your seed is also forbidden, these kinds of things. So it's, you know, discipline that it's suggesting that leads to someone's being kadosh. This is a little bit different from other types of conversation about male members, which I'd like to point out. So this book is a really fantastic book about bodily Israel, reading sex in Talmudic culture. It's called Carnal Israel. And this is a professor, maybe people know the New York-based Jonathan Boyarin. He's a sociologist of religion, written a lot in that way. Daniel Boyarin is an incredible Talmudist. He's at Berkeley. And he is, you can't define what he does. If there's a language he needs to know, he learns it. If there's a subject about which he doesn't know, he studies it. He is a linguist. He's a literary critic. And he knows Talmud in and out. And so we had the delight of learning with him at the UJ, at the University of Judaism Ziegler School, when I was there in the Beit Midrash. And I copied a page for you from the seventh chapter of this book. Look at these. Look here at this page, chapter 7. Reproducing men, constructing the rabbinic male body. Said Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Ishmael, the son of Yossi's member, was like a wineskin of 9 kav. Rabbi Elazar, the son of Rabbi Shimon's member, was like a wineskin of 7 kav. Rabbi Papa said Rabbi Yochanan's member was like a wineskin of 3 kav. And there are those who say like a wineskin of 5 kav. Rav Papa himself had a member which was like the baskets of Hippanim.
They seem to be looking at each other.
Oh, that's exactly it. Not only, well, if you say that it's kadosh not to look at your own, and they are resisting looking at their own and thusly looking at others, it's in order to inform each other about the size, okay, then we're in concert with ours. But if you say that it seems like a discussion about the male member and the size thereof is not just the fodder of jokes and modernity, but the actual conversation of rabbis in terms of the hagiography of certain rabbi, because this comes from pages where we're kind of discovering who is Rabbi Elazar, the son of Rabbi Shimon. You see that they're going into the real physicality, the real sexuality of what it means to be a human being. And they're doing it, according to Bayoran, just to make a long book short, but it's a fantastic, fantastic read for anyone who's really into the depths of Talmudic culture in kind of a new literary critical way. He says that they were very concerned about A, corporealness and the rabbinic male body and graphing onto it, you know, the kind of grotesque realism that we found in Rabelais, and so you see that he goes down and he says that literature has this within Renaissance period and in modernity. We understand it through Bakhtin's work, that there's a grotesqueness and a burlesqueness and a relationship to the physical, to say that one's being is traveling through time and space. The notion of keeping all of that in the great masterpiece Gargantua and Pentagruel by Rabelais was this exploration of this travel text where the characters traveled, and the burlesque discussions, especially scatological discussions, were all about, you know, discovering oneself, discovering the mysteries of the world. And it's meant to be extremely satirical, extremely funny. And so too here with the rabbis, perhaps, and that there's a certain embrace of the reality of their bodies, the reality that such a thing could happen in the midst of the rabbis being in the bathhouse, and as it relates to women's bodies and women being the bayit and the home and ready to receive their rabbis as the builders of the families of Israel, and that when these rabbis who have such members of however many kav really their members are, that when they don't use them and perform with them, they show very much, and further in that chapter, that there's grounds for divorce, and that it is a certain power of the feminine that she has, because she's the one who's really key to the progeny of Israel and procreation, and they are stuck sometimes on the notion of whose is 5 and whose is 3 and whose is 7, and the kind of grotesque reality that you have to inhabit your beingness, you have to inhabit your bodily reality, you have to inhabit your corporeality and understand what to do with it in terms of godliness or not. And this is the exploration sometimes that comes through in Bakhtin's philosophy, where Boyarin suggested that we all go out and read the treatise in preparation for the book, and he's got one of these kinds of philosophical treatises practically for each chapter that he's written. And here he's talking about the notion that beingness, according to this Russian philosopher, is bound up in understanding that you are a being and you have potential. And just your being without realizing potential and moving towards potential is antithetical to what he calls the obligation of existence. And so your obligation of existence is sometimes bound up with one part of who you are, and thusly, Boyarin is locating the obligation that the rabbis are putting within human beings and humanity, especially the rabbis, in terms of procreation. And saying, if you don't act on it, for sure, you don't deserve to be. So this is kind of the underpinnings of some of the work.
Something else that strikes me, you know, coming off the remark of TMI, too much information,
right.
Which my actually granddaughter is fond of saying to me. But the rabbis don't run away from any subject. The most basic thing, and nothing is forbidden to look at. I mean, what they do is they delve into everything.
I think you're right. I think, you know, there's a Mishnah that says everything is in it. You know, turn it over.
So to say I'm not going to back off limits is counter to what nothing is off limits. Because if you put something off limits...
I think what he's talking about is the phenomenon that it seems so enormously in line with some of the grotesque reality, some of the burlesque reality that we found in other cultures, and that we wouldn't maybe expect it to be exactly like that.
Well, I mean, recognizing that this is all serious and has to be discussed seriously, there's also, I mean, you can't help reading this but think they're tweaking Rabbi Yossi a little bit, and there's a little bit of, you know, so I guess the inference here is that Rabbi Yossi did have his hand beneath his belt, otherwise he would have been called Kadosh. Right? So there's a little bit of, you know, oh, you're so modest, you know, and so on and so forth. So, and by the way, if you don't mind my asking, how big is a Kav?
Since the Olympics are in progress.
This is a basic unit of measurement from which many other small units are derived. 1/6 of a seah, or 24 eggs. So you take the white parts of an egg in order to understand Talmudic measurements, and you put them all in a cup, and then you get that. The expression kabayim is frequently used as is the expression half a kab. So this is a great book for anyone looking for measurements in Talmud. It's a reference guide.
And the liquid measure?
Well, but you're measuring it and then you have cup.
So
we're changing the shape. But you're getting a sense of the mass.
A kab is basically
one sixth
of a seah, or 24 eggs.
Oh, 24 eggs. 24 eggs.
No. So it's actually saying, what is it really saying? It may not be saying exactly about the length per se. It may be saying that inside their body, it seems like when they urinate forever.
Now, that's also to say that a wineskin that holds X amount can be very large or small. And so when Professor Boyarin was explaining this, the note that I had in the was that, you know, it could look like it was big enough to be such a wineskin of such volume. And so, you know, a huge, huge amount. And it's so, that's what I say about grotesque reality. Perhaps the question is really well taken, because if you don't think about it that way, you really don't see that they're kind of exaggerating. It's not as grotesque. If you don't think about it volume-wise that way.
I think I remember years ago learning a section in which a couple of the rabbis were bragging, actually, about not the number, but about their bellies and how it is above a messiah.
Yeah, the rabbis were very bodily in that way.
In that context, you might say, bunch of fraternity boys.
That's right.
Old male environment anyway.
That's right.
And wouldn't be surprising if they weren't.
That's right. Boyarin's next book.
Whether it's bragging or whatever.
Boyarin's next book is all about, again, the production of the rabbinic hero, and how the rabbinic hero brags about its size of this and the size of that, but really never goes to war, doesn't pick up weapons, isn't necessarily a sports jock, you know, but that the rabbinic hero is someone who realizes that they have these body parts, they can make arguments a little bit talmudically even about these body parts, and that's heroic within Jewish maleness.
I was just wondering, do we know about other cultures where there's a requirement that the husband fulfill, you know, or have a certain amount of relations with the wife? You would think it would be the other way around, that the woman would be required to make the husband happy in a certain periodic framework. So was this done in other ancient cultures?
Well, we know this Mishnah is fleshed out in one of these chapters, and for sure sexual intercourse is not seen as a digression from seriousness about Torah study, nor is it seen as completely leaving someone out of the circle of those who would be students of the tradition. What we know very deeply is that one development of the world of Christendom at the time is to completely reject corporeality and reject the sex act, and the being married to God becomes then, for the idealistic notion of priesthood or religious expression, the non-corporeal marriage of one to the divine. And so in this theater of religious development, rabbinic theater of development, we see for sure that it's even within Jewish groups as well. So the Essenes, if we read some of the Dead Sea Scrolls correctly, also believe very much that the sex act and reproduction, or another group if it's not the Essenes, because we still debate about who these groups are, really rejected the notion of family a la what the rabbi's project is doing with reproduction.
So they're really affirming this in a climate of retreating from...
I don't want to overstate it. I imagine that at the time there were those who, A, didn't go as far as who would become the church fathers, if they weren't church fathers already, seen like that. I don't know enough about early Christian history to know whether or not the originators of such celibacy ideas and the like are counsel to the scriptural writers, or themselves the scriptural writers and writers of letters that become canonized within church fathers literature. For sure there was in the, let's say, genius level of religious thinking, productivity of religious culture, the production of religious culture, there were these ideas at odds with one another. I don't know what all of Amcha was thinking.
So, to me, the Brit has to do with being as plentiful as the sand on the and fish in the sea, and so the absolute centrality of procreation to Judaism is its essence. And so it's not at all surprising to me, if you're taking that as the linear descent, it's got to be something of major, major concern. And also, you know, there are the theories about, you know, Judaism encouraged its most talented to be most productive in procreation as well.
Right.
And obviously, if you have a Brian priest who never has any children, well, that's the end of that line.
Right.
So, I mean, I think that there is really a very central set of issues here that
that define the core of Jewish of the Jewish experience.
Yeah.
Of course.
Look, you have these five cedars coming from,
exactly.
You know, Rabbi Yossi.
Right.
And though he wasn't called Rabbi Yossi HaKadosh, he was the progenitor of these major figures.
And five times five times five.
Right.
Times five times five times five.
It doesn't work like this. When they ask Einstein how come he is so smart, they have to go ask my father. You know. It's not, there is no promise by generation.
No guarantee. We know, no guarantee.
Right.
So. No guarantee.
Right.
It's more story than reality.
But what Barry is saying, that means that everybody can be every night like one who is of independent means. But, so, with our goal is to have procreation, but the reality is you go to sea and you travel and you have other demands on you. So within those two things, they're figuring out some kind of schedule for people to live their normal lives and to also keep this as a goal.
Right.
I just see it a little bit differently. I think much of this is geared towards the men wanting to keep their women, in essence, knowing who was the father of the child. Because remember, you need only a couple of men. And you need a lot of women to keep a society going. And I read it as that's what they're saying to the woman. You be patient, so that you don't go be promiscuous with other men because you have that interest. And this is what you can expect. So I see it as a very interesting tell of the men. It's their fear that this is expressing, not their potency. I mean, you first read it as potency, but I think it's fear.
But I mean, it's coming from the women because they pay a higher price in the production, much higher than the men. Because for her to have a kid, it takes 20 years. You can jump from woman to woman. So I think for her, to protect her...
Look, Boyarin agrees with Yarid. Says that women were called beiti, kept in the house, kept out of the public, and shouldn't be yatsanit, shouldn't be one who goes out, shouldn't have your head uncovered, shouldn't be an object of sexual desire, etc., etc., because they need to be doing the one job they should do. And this is what defines a rabbinic culture of procreation. So Boyarin says this a couple pages down the line again in that chapter. It's a wonderful read. Let's push on and see what else Rabbi Yossi is about. He says, Amar Rabbi Yossi, I'm on 118b4 now. Me'amai lo ra'u korot beiti imrei chaluke. In all my days, the beams of my house, I've never seen the seams of my tunic. Meaning he had a modest way of taking off his garment. He didn't just go like this and show everybody the seams, like, you know, no inside out. You want to be modest in the world? You don't have anything inside out. So this goes to the laws of modesty today. Remember, I lived in a house with 9 children, and it was a Haredi household, a very, very religious household. Not a single one of the young kids from a very early age took off anything that turned anything inside out. You slipped an arm out, you took things off in a way, especially if a young lady was taking off a sweater, it was always an arm first, sitting down on a couch, legs crossed. You had real thoughtful ways of disrobing even an outer layer. And it was very noticeable. And as soon as you read this Gemara, you realize that it's very, very intentful according to Rabbi Yossi. Part of today's reality is that, I traveled a lot with kids. Kids did not realize, starting 6th, 7th, 8th grade, especially at that age where people are not aware entirely, and then into high school, there are many times when someone will disrobe inadvertently, not to be overtly sexual, but in a way that is a little bit not so concerned with modesty. And then ultimately is a moment of embarrassment and or a moment of, what would you call it? Awkwardness or revealing something that one wouldn't desire to. So it's just interesting that that's part of the Gemara already and a suggestion about how we ought to think about what we do in terms of proper ways of strobing, even with outer garments and inner garments. But Rabbi Yossi would sit down on the bed, according to the Rishonim. In all my days, what? And he says also, Mi'amai lo avarti al divrei chaverai. And in all my days, I've never disobeyed the words of my colleagues. Now, an interesting kind of pursuit here of what he's really meaning. So, for instance, he says, Yodea ani ba'atmi she'eini kohen. I know, for example, that I'm not a kohen. Im omrim li chaverai ale leduchan. But if my friends say to me, go up and duchen. Heard this term, duchen? When Kohanim go up to bless the congregation, in the active way that the Kohenic blessing is performed by people with Kohenic lineage in the Musaf services of the High Holidays and Yontif for most or many shuls, still around the conservative world, and still very much in the Orthodox world, and for every day in Israel, where the Kohenic blessing is part of the repetition of the Amidah, when you get to Yivrechana Vishmarecha, Ken Yihiratzon, well, you answer Amen to the Kohanim who are up there. Has anyone ever seen this and witnessed this, right? You have Kohanim, and they're under their talit, their head covered. Their hands are out like this, underneath the talit. You're to look away. Some people turn completely and face the opposite direction. The Rambam says that we shouldn't entirely face the opposite direction and have our back to the Kohanim. And it's actually one of the few places, well, there are several places that we actually make a pasak, according to the Rambam, where generally the rule is in halachic codes, we don't make halachic norms according to the Rambam's Mishnah Torah. This one is. And the Kohenic blessing is going to be said up there where the Kohanim go, and they're going to say Yivarecha Adonai Bishmerecha, and the part that Kohanim are supposed to bless. And he says, even though I'm not a Kohen, if they say to me, go up in Duchen, go up to the Duchan, go become part of the Kohenic blessing, Ani Ole, I go up. But I have to say that the discussions are wide and long about, this one moment in Rabbi Yossi's practice. First of all, what sounds wrong?
He's not authorized.
He's not a Kohen. So, immediately, there's some real issue here where Ani Ole, I go up. So the Tosafot, you see the note, let's start with the note in the art scroll. Tosafot says, who wonders what prohibition may be incurred by doing this? Ramah points out that a non-Kohen who performs this procedure of Birkat Kohanim transgresses a positive commandment. As the Gemara states in Ketubot 24b, numerous Achronim discuss the issue. Okay? So I wanted to just give you a little bit of the sense of the discussion. This is a Gemara called Mativta. It has many, many different kinds of commentaries and summaries of commentaries and fantastic writings on Rashi entries, let's say, and looks to the core of what Rashi is really relating to and the philosophy behind the Rashi, or the philosophy behind the Maharshah, which was the first of the Rishonim behind the tractate in the Gemara. So I thought this an interesting entry on our Rabbi Yossi's statement here. So the Tosafot. What do the Tosafot say? Tamehu. They are surprised. Eza Yisur Yeshu Ba'aliyah L'duchan. Isn't there some kind of forbidden nature of what's going on if he goes up to say the blessings of the Kohen? Ad She Rabbi Yossi Ra'at Tzorech L'hadgish V'lomar She'gam Im Yomru Lo La'alot L'duchan Lo Yehesas Eila Ya'aleh K'dei Lo La'avur Al Divrei Chaverah. And how was it that really Rabbi Yossi was saying that if I had friends who told me, look, go up there and say this blessing with the Kohanim, I am not going to go back on what you're telling me. I'm not going to transgress the words of my colleagues. When he says chaverav, he doesn't mean friends. He means his colleagues. Ki ma isur yesh bazar ha'oleh l'duchan? Because isn't there some kind of forbidden nature of this practice, and there's someone who's not a Kohen going up to actually give the Kohenic blessing? Im lo mishum bracha levatla. If not, but for the fact that even in the most basic sense, he's got to say a blessing, because remember the beginning of the process of saying the Kohenic blessing is to pronounce the blessing. Asher kitshanu, who commanded us to give the blessing of Aharon, the high priest. So that in of itself, a bracha levatala, a bracha that is for no, is a transgression in a way that our system cannot stand to have such a transgression made. Bilvad amra haTorah livarechet Yisrael, and the Torah explains that only Kohanim should be the ones to bless Yisrael, to bless the Jews. Ubevadai shelo ha'ita kavanato, but here's the answer: it wasn't really his intention to go up there. Shela sheyaale v'gam yivarech. It wasn't his intention that he's going to go up there and state the blessing, and say the blessing. He was going to go up there. He was going to listen to his friends, but he himself would refrain from actually saying the blessing. That's obviously the solution. Because he didn't want to, A, embarrass them. Maybe it's the middle of the service, and they say, go up. He doesn't want to get into an argument, but he's not going to actually say the blessing, because he knew what the Torah requires, according to the way the text, the Tosfot are laying it out, that to say that would be a bracha levatala. Biksha Adarche Moshe, and here we have another kind of approach by the Darche Moshe. Shehare mevu'ar b'ketubot, it's said in Ketubot, sheyesh isor ase lezara nosei et kapav. But we have an issue even with someone going up and covering his head and being in a stance that looks like he's actually going to perform the Birkat HaKohanim. This is a problem. The Maharsha Ketav Le'ashev, and the Maharsha gives us an answer to such a problem. She Tosfot Evinu Shelo Ha'ita Kavanato Shel Rav Yosi Levarechet Yisrael. The Tosfot say he didn't have the intention to actually pronounce the blessing. Elo Rach La'alot, rather only to go up. U'chil Shono Im Omrim Li Chaverai Ale L'Duchan V'Al Kach Tameu. And here's what they really said. Their problem was, even if he went up, there's a problem. Eze isur yesh b'davar. What was there really such a big problem with that? U'memele nitkashu ma hachidush sheyesh b'davarav. V'ra'a ma shekatav abach al derech ze u'v'tosafot arosh katav. But here's the way that they were going to solve, you know, the problem, even if he goes up. The Tosfot Arosh says she bevaday lo haita kavanat Rabbi Yosi la'alot l'duchan, that it really wasn't even his intention to go up to be part of the Kohenic blessing. Shehare yesh isur b'davar, because he knew that there was a forbidden nature to going up and doing that. Ela al derech haflaga markein v'chavanato shegam davar gadol haiti oseh bishvil chaverai. That his true intention was to say that even though I know there's an Isur in this, there's a forbidden nature to this, when it comes to the colleague's words that I have to respect here, I'm willing to go and transgress to this level. And so, Uvataz, and in another Torah Zahav, which is another commentary to the law code, Shekavanat Rabbi Yosi hi she'af shehu ba'atzmo yodeya she'eno kohen, even though he knows he's not a kohen, ach im yomru lo chavirav shehu kein kohen, if his colleagues say that he is a kohen, yivatel et da'ato v'yaleh l'duchan, he will suppress his own sense and opinion at that moment, and he will go up to the duchan. So you have within this discussion the notion that his intentionality and his knowledge about a halachic status and what is right by way of the legal codes does have a certain place of respectfulness, tzniuta again, modesty, when it comes to the particular colleagues that tell him you should be up there. What is at the heart of the matter? It doesn't say in these sources that I read to you or in the originals that I can find. I believe that what's at the heart of it is where in another place in the Shulchan Aruch it says that all Kohenic identity in our time, and this is already, I think, 16th centuries the first place this appears. I'd have to check exactly where the first time the statement appears. But that there's a part of our Shulchan Aruch that says Kohenic identity is in safek. It is in doubt. And that we live with a certain amount of doubt regarding Kohenic identity, though people self-identify as a Kohen. So what I think is that it's delving deeply into the notion here that these Haverim, these colleagues that he had, may have known or felt they knew that he came from a line of Kohanim.
It's not an issue that they want him, they consider him as the leader, and they wanted him to be there while the bracha on the bima, like a leader.
Let's say that the alternative possibility is this. I've told you before about the tension between the Kohanim and the way the Pharisees want the Tzedukim, the way the rabbis want to integrate Kohenic culture in ways they can. So wouldn't it make sense that their most well-regarded leaders should have the merit to go up and say this blessing within the context of the Amidah, the central tefillah that is from the assembly of the great men and the rabbis, the central feature of a religious service? I think that is a theory that we could go with as well.
I'll give an anecdote that supports that. So, just because of medical interactions, I happen to know the head of the Sefer of our community here, and he is not a Kohen, but he will not go in to the funeral parlor. So he's adopted a Kohanic position about that, even though he makes no claim to being a Kohen, but because he's the leader of the community, that's what he's decided is the appropriate thing for him to do. In modern times.
I wonder what he has he written about that? Do you know?
I
wonder how he holds, in other words, what is his reasoning, but it's very fascinating.
I assume Rabbi Yossi states as a principle that he does not contradict his chevra when they tell him to do something or to say something to him. And the reason for that is what? Modesty?
Well, one notion here is that he doesn't want to make embarrass them, make a stink in public. He doesn't want to get into a back and forth, especially during the course of a service.
Okay, in this case, that's not a general principle if somebody were to tell him this.
Well, I think he's trying to make it a little bit more of a general principle. In other words, there are times to actually disagree with your colleagues and there are times not to.
I would think this is a time when there's no harm in disagreeing because you're not questioning their reasoning or their theories. It's just, not a Kohen, so it shouldn't be up there. I mean, you have to presume that, unless as you're saying, I don't know, I'm having trouble, given the care that Chazal had for Halacha, I'm having a hard time believing that they said it's a sign of respect or because you're important, you should be up there when it's inappropriate for you to be up there. And everybody was known by their patronymic at the time, and anyone would have known whether he's a Kohen or not. So I'm having trouble with the story. I don't know what to make. But it doesn't seem to make sense to me that he's going up there even though it's
you're fun. Not alone. You're not alone.
In the Beit Knesset, you have to behave in a certain way. We know that from what we studied. If you came back from a trip, it's called Lamoid, or it's just before you...
Right, there's a cultural piece in here. Rabbinic cultural piece.
Yeah.
He doesn't want to necessarily overstep the bounds.
Somebody says hello to you and doesn't want to be
distracted. So, in trying to make sense of kind of the three things grouped together, I think that there is a great degree of modesty that he is talking about in the first thing, that he never saw the seams of his clothing. So he's really, to a great degree, And I think maybe it's the public nature of them calling him up. So maybe if someone said to him privately, he could do it, he said, oh, I'm not a Kohen. But here they are in the middle of this thing, and they are his colleagues, and they say, come up. And for him to say, while everybody is looking and it's all going on, it would be for him to correct them as though they're wrong and they don't know. So perhaps he is going to a degree of consideration of someone to be publicly contradicted in the middle of something. And the third one is that he will not back down about something that he had said something about someone and had to retreat when he confronted me. So how would we put that into an extreme sense of being consistent or something?
You're reading the end of the piece.
Yeah.
So let's just read the end of the piece out loud. Because we want to put it together. The last thing he says is that... And Rabbi Yossi adds, "Mian I lo amarti davar v'chazarti la'achorei." In all my days, I've never said something about someone and had to retreat when he confronted me. And that is to say that he only spoke, you know, truthfully, and that, you know, confronted is the word that the translators here felt. But I'm not sure that there's the word confront. The Hebrew is simply, I didn't have to go back when it was kind of brought back to me. So if I said somebody about something, and then, you know, did you say about me the following? He really never had to say, I would never say that. You know, he never had one of those moments where he had to do that, because he was the type of upstanding soul where he would really not have such an issue. There are those who hold their words back a little bit more than others, who decide to say little, you know, do much or not. And there are those who let words fly. I think part of, honestly, I think it's true. And I think that you have people who were very serious about defining Lashon Hara. And they already were doing this. It wasn't a Chabad Chaim in the 19th, 20th century who were serious about Lashon Hara, that the issue here is really about what he did feel was Lashon Hara or not. And let me just see for a second. No, that's not the spot. The issue is whether or not he felt it was Lashon Hara, and maybe it's over here. Yeah, so I just want to point out that one, and I told you before that there are several Hasidic commentaries regarding Talmudic passages because of the learning going on within the communities that these Talmudists represent. Tiferet Shlomo happens to be an extremely, extremely busy Talmudist at the same time that he's into the socio-mysticism of Chassidut and popularizing in that way the kind of overlay of Dveikut and godliness and saintliness, but he's into his Gemara learning. And he says, you know, Pirash Rashi, Uchasavar kol milta de mit amra v'api mara leit ba mishum lishna bisha, that Rashi says, whatever I thought I said about somebody, I really did believe that there was not a single really word to embarrass another person.
So I think it's the embarrassment. I think embarrassment is such a central and important feature about behavior and to build a community culture. And I may have misremembered this, but I think there's a discussion about how embarrassing somebody was the root cause of why Jerusalem fell.
For sure you have Hamalbim Pnei Chavero Barabim Memitoto, that embarrassing someone in public is like killing somebody,
right.
And that Sinat Chinam, we say baseless hatred, is the second temple, but part of the culture that's, you know, B'yirida,
right.
that's lessening over time by way of the Jewish people and the temple cultures. And the times of the temple is being able to respect one another. Here you have the alternative, and I'm reading from the, I was just quoting the Rashi, but I was reading from the left-hand side of the back page of your packet, if you want to follow along in the Hebrew again, from that book of, this is Berech Hasidut Alashash, the clarifications that Hasidic masters make on the Talmud. And so the top entry, kind of where I have the gray piece of paper, kind of at the top of it, Umipne Shehaya, at the end of the smaller Hebrew, because the top is the quote of our Gemara. I'm at the very back of the package, on the left-hand side, in the smaller here, the back of the package, yeah, left-hand side, smaller Hebrew, okay, Umipne Shehaya Nizhar Milashon Hara, because he was so careful about Lashon Hara, not speaking it, Haya Ra'ui Levarechet Yisrael, he felt himself worthy of actually saying the blessing, and this is why some people think Hasidic masters are a little bit antinomian, right? Because ultimately he transgresses and he actually even says the blessing, Be'ahava, which is in quotes because it's the end of the blessing that the Kohanim say when they are duchening. So the Shaliach Tzibur says, Kohanim, and the Kohanim make a bracha, Baruch, Ata, Hashem, Amivarech, Adamo Yisrael, Be'ahava. Right? So, and then the Kohanim start their blessing. They turn around and they face the community. And so he even felt that he could do that, say that blessing, and go and bless the Jewish people with this blessing of peace. Kamo Shapirish Rashi, Al Pasuk, Ko Tivarchu, Milashona Kodesh, that he could actually say the blessing that the Kohanim would say in this language, this Hebrew. Ki Rak Misha Lishono Kodesh, Hu Ra'ui Levarechet Yisrael. Because whoever's language is holy is the one who has the zechut, who has the merit to bless Israel. Now, Jay, getting back into the problem that all these others have, and they're sitting with you in the Beit Midrash, and we have all this, you know, how can we possibly understand with all the attention that halachists pay to the details of halacha? Here you have the master Gemara student, who did become a Rebbe, but who is a Talmudist through and through, and is known for that before he becomes a Hasidic master and is turned on by the courts of Hasidim, the Tiferet Shlomo. He says, let me make the shiluv, let me make the fullness of the texts that I've read about this, the Rishonim and the Achronim on the Sugya, come to life. And that is, I think he did actually go up to say the bracha. He didn't stop himself, like the Tosfot said. He didn't just go up and say, I'm not going to say the blessing because I know that's still right, not allowed. I know that's by Torah law not allowed. And he didn't just go up and know that he was transgressing on the just going up part. He actually said it. Because maybe he felt his Lashon was so Kodesh, going back to maybe, Barry, what you're saying about the Sefer Rebbe, that he took on this Kohenic kind of minhag or kind of practice within the realm of his holiness and his leadership of the community. So it's very interesting to bring in such a commentary from a 19th century Hasidic master who is a Talmudist long before he's a Hasid, and criticize him as being antinomian. Because really, he's not coming from only a Hasidic purview, a Hasidic worldview. He's considering this from a yeshiva worldview, one that likes to take all the different extant texts by the time he's alive and kind of make an understanding of what potentially is going on here, especially in light, he's saying, of the last part of the sugya, where he doesn't say a bad thing, and when it comes back to him, he doesn't have to recant. Because here we have a holistic view of what it means to be a modest soul in the world. So I think it's a very exciting commentary in that vein that pulls together a lot. He's the Radamska Rebbe.
There's a clue here in the relation between the first part, which is lifting the garment over your head like this, and taking the talis and putting it over you. Do you think there was a tzniut issue about the duchenim that we're missing, or, you know, is there any literature about that? Because it's quite, you know, stark here that the first part of this triad, you could get a visual impression of someone disrobing, looking like a Kohen doing duchana.
It's a good question. I haven't seen literature about it. I didn't see any connections between number one and two and three, though I think two and three come to start coalescence within the last comment I read by the Tiferet Shlomo. So no, I can't say that it's connection, but it's a very nice question. You should write it in the margin of your Gemara.
It's very interesting because there are these, you know, kind of almost free association connections that happen. Like
no
why
doubt.
We're talking about such and such, and they go into something. So why not be the gesture, the kind of physicality of being connected?
Yeah. You know, one feature of Daniel Boyarin's work is to do what you're asking now within your literary approach in the Beit Midrash here. And he says that before our era, that asking such a literary question was not the purview of scholars, even in the great projects of Wissenschaft Judentums and the notion of actually having formed critical analysis. It turns out that Dr. Shama Friedman, who just won the Israel Prize for his great research, I think I mentioned within class, that he's a codifier of the different manuscripts of the Gemara we have, and he looks for the Shinui Girsaot, and he does form critical analysis, and he really introduces methodologies that are just mind-blowing about Gemaras and what are the historical kernels of things. And they're not all the time looking for connections such as this. That's not really what they were about. And so as we develop more questions around these things because of the relationship between numbers 1 and 2 and 3, you know, it's worth mining other texts to see if anyone has. There are a few people earlier on who did it.
There's even the issue of don't look.
Right.
You know, it's like we grew up in our shul, we were growing up, we used to do Duchanan every Shabbos. And it was something, and my father used to put his big talus around us and watch, you know, he kind of wanted to be, but I literally thought I would be killed if I did it.
Right.
A long time. I was at least 7 years old before I
had it. Right. There is in circles that hold this to be very, very, you know, channeling of divine energy into the world. It's very serious in the shuls where I was with the Jerusalem family. You know, this was a run to get under the father's talit. In Teaneck, where we were for 7 years, and it's a very common part of holiday davening in many conservative shuls, and there is a certain kind of amazing closeness that this created among families, and you should see the pictures of, you know, in your mind of men and women creating spaces for their children and one another, even for the blessing of the Kohanim and the turn of the congregation a little bit to the angle. And you know, the memory I have of seeing my children grow under my talit over the years is something that, frankly, you just never forget. And it's very powerful. Very powerful. So I don't know about the connection, but just to mention that the Birch HaKohanim came into play here. Again, a notion of Kohenic, a nod to the Kohenic reality, that is part and parcel of the cultural adaptation that we're going to have to think of vis-a-vis just that part of historical reality. And Shabbat, you know, not exactly in focus here by way of some of these things, but potentially. Was it an act on Shabbat that he did? We don't know. Let's move forward so we can read a little bit more Gemara. Now we're going to have statements about different Amoraim who were exceedingly careful in the observance of particular mitzvot. We're going to get into a place where we see that they were really serious about one or another mitzvah. So Rav Nachman says, Amar Rav Nachman, Teitili dekayemi shalosh sudo v'shabbat. So Teitili is an interesting phrase. It means, may it come back to me a reward, or may it be reckoned for me that I did this, or a reward given me, that I faithfully was involved in making three meals on the Sabbath. And we've talked about meals and their importance, so we'll just keep rolling through. Rav Yehuda says, Teiti li dekayemit iyun tefillah. Please, may a reward come my way for having practiced contemplation of my prayer. Iyun tefillah is one of the items on the list that is really asked for or desired in Elu Devarim She'Adam Ochel Peder Oteim Ba'Olam Hazeh Va'Keren Kayemet Lo La'Olam Haba. These are the things that you do without measure. Their reward in this world is without measure, and the reward in the next world is without measure. And it's mentioned at the beginning of the Sidur proper. It's part of a Gemara passage. And there's a little bit of a machloket. Does it mean iyun tefillah as in lengthening a prayer and leading prayer in such a way as to really be lengthy? No. That's not the iyun tefillah we're talking about, because all over the Gemara, that kind of iyun is really not called for. What is interesting is that iyun tefillah is an investigation of one's prayer. It's a look at one's prayer in terms of the meaning thereof. It's a figuring out how to pray without wondering about the exact time of one's request and whether or not one's bakasha will be answered or not. So there's two things. One shouldn't totally lengthen, and one shouldn't make a request and then try to calculate exactly when it's going to be answered. The investigation of prayer, that's a different story, and that's what most of the Farshim think we're talking about with this kind of iyun tefillah. So then, Amar Rabbi Huna Barei de Rav Yehoshua, Rabbi Huna, the son of Rabbi Yehuda, then says, Tete li de lo sagina arba amot begilui arosh. May a reward come my way for never having gone four amot with my head uncovered. So you see the note here that having your head uncovered is a very strong minhag in Israel. It's considered minhag avotenu biyadenu, the category of Jewish law that says the custom of our fathers, minhag avotenu biyadenu, has come to the force of law. Biyadenu means in our hands, but really the phrase is a legal phrase that means that covering one's head when one goes is now to the point of law. So those who feel like the kippah is custom really don't think about the status thereof being law and mitzvah in that vein. So there are those who say it's custom, but a lot of poskim really do say already it's law because of the principle minhag avotenu biyadenu. And we could explore really, though, that phrase and see. Does it really mean it's the same level as a mitzvah derabbanan or a mitzvah deraita, a rabbinic injunction or a Torahitic law? But for all intents and purposes, this is parallel to a Gemara in Kiddushin, which says that this sage was properly adorned and dressed and went with the deep respect that Talmidei Chachamim, that the sages should in the world, by having his head covered. Do we think that it looked like this? We don't think it looked like this. We think that it was more a wrap of some sort, for sure, potentially a square in a folded into a triangle with the two ends twisted and then twisted around like a keffiyeh. We believe that perhaps there was another kind of rabbinic head covering in that day that allowed for more space for the tefillin, because the rabbis who wore tefillin all day did not need something that tied off in the front like a regular keffiyeh would, so that it was a little bit held back this way and that the tefillin shel rosh was here. But these investigations don't come up with anything solidly. We have good theories, and you can look for the notion of head coverings costume in the Encyclopedia Judaica and other places like that in the Jewish Encyclopedia Online. So then, Tete li l'kayamit mitzvah tefillin, may a reward come to me because I observe the mitzvah of tefillin, and that again was like kind of the all-day notion of tefillin. And except for the bathroom, the sages walked around with these tefillin on, and
on their arm as well?
On their arm and on their head. And we know that arm and head tefillin were extant and found them in the Dead Sea region, and we found some evidence earlier of at least the prayers written on them. And so ancient tefillin, again, extant, found in archaeological digs. We're searching for more as we sift through the southern wall excavation and Temple Mount area.
What's the evidence that they wore it all day?
Well, the Gemara talks about it so often.
Really?
Halacha talks about
day?
It often, yeah, that it was an all-day affair. And there are stories, so it's both what seems apodictic, kadific, and what seems agadic, such as when a certain rabbi or another would wear the tefillin and then his handmaid would come and say, listen, you need to take those off before you go into the bathroom, let me help you or not, and he could or he couldn't, as he's in his dying days.
I'm surprised, since they're obviously trying to one-up each other, I'm surprised that someone would choose one that isn't in the Torah.
You know what's interesting? I don't know if they're trying to one-up here as much as the culture of really having a mitzvah that you're known for is coming through here. what's happening here, and some people really hold that is what's going on here, that there's a certain kind of expertise that's being developed. And when you want to know about such a mitzvah...
The maven.
Right, so...
Each a maven and a different mitzvah.
Right. When I first heard a lecture about it, I thought of this perek that would be really interesting. You know how they make those books based on historical fiction? Like, these were the experts on these. And so a person would go on a journey and take counsel with each of these rabbis in order to understand what was it like at that time, and what was it going to be about, and how are we going to make enough to progress this mitzvah in the world, and these kinds of matters. Because the final one is for having observed the mitzvah tzitzit. Each of these has a certain kind of expertise associated with them, and the one of the meal about the bread and about making sure you have the right provisions and what can you heat up, what can you not heat up, contemplation of prayer. The notion at that time that you didn't have siddurim, remember, you had prayer kind of locked up within certain people who knew the nusach of prayer, the different ways you order prayer, and so on. So how to tie the head wrap, and what kind of wraps were right, and maybe who's seller. So I think there's a real part of that here, and the dye of the techelet. What's that?
What kind of Boy Scout
back? I would imagine that these rabbis taught one another these kinds of things. For sure it happens today with tefillin knots. There are some people who are really great at those knots. And the Sefer Tameh Minhagim, the reasons and the lessons about the customs, has a diagram in the back. But let me tell you something, not everybody is so proficient with doing those things. Until you really see someone that sits you down and they help you tie these things out and figure out the where, and you know, what else could be better Boy Scout material than the knots themselves? And there's a couple of a couple of people in any shul and a couple of kids in any given grade level that become the experts around, so that when a knot is a little too loose, because remember I told you that head tefillin really, the hairline is the place where the end of the head tefillin box is, by way of halacha and the rabbis. So a lot of times what happens is this expands. People's hair and heads, they kind of let the leather swells a little bit, it drops, and then you have to really retie that knot. And it should be kind of at the base of the skull here in that soft spot, and the top should only go about this far down, the end of the box. So there's this retying that had to happen often. As leather becomes supple over use, this is part of the way that you have the culture of the synagogue. So, anyhow, that is some of the stories. And then you even have some, very severe and significant attention paid to the mitzvah of tzitzit here by Rav Yosef, said to Rav Yosef, the son of Rabba, Avuch b'mai zahir tafe, in which mitzvah was your father especially careful? Amarle, he replied to him, b'tzitzit, in the mitzvah of tzitzit, yoma chad hava kasalik bedarga, one day he was up on a ladder, Ipsik le chuta, one of the strands was cut short, obviously got caught in one of the rungs. Velo nachit va'ata kama delo ramye. And he didn't come back down until he had hung another thread in its place. Give me a tzitzit, I can't come back down to the ground without my tzitzit. This happens. So if you wear a tzitzit and you have one of the strings or another come, and you're serious about wearing them all the time, and it kind of gets caught, you know how if you could happen with a coat or a dress or a tallit, if you don't have benches like ours, you get it caught in that little crease of the chair, right? And you pull yourself, and then all of a sudden, So people were serious about their tzitzit. A lot of places had extra tzitzit strings on hand. I've been to synagogues where you have a little box, and in the box you could put a little tzedakah in, and you can take a new set of strings. They have these kind of things readily available, people who would like. And these are kind of ways that you prepare for life if you're serious about.
But on a ladder, you'll do it.
On a ladder, I don't know that they have it in the toolbox. I'm talking about the shoe. Similar statements from another Amora, Amar Abaye. Tete li dechi chazinet surba merabin an deshlim masechte. And Rabbi says, may a reward come my way, because whenever I see a young Talmudic scholar whose tractate has been completed, Avidna Yaimat Tavel Rabbanan, I make a yantif for the rabbis. Yantif here means what?
Mashke.
Mashke. I make a siyum. I make a nice meal. Did Abaye learn the tractate? No, the Sorba the Rabbanan did. The youthful sages finished the Masechta. Abaye comes along and says, you finished the Masechta? I want to throw a party. I want to invite all my friends. Bedoro says the Perush, I'm reading again from the Matif de Gemara, it's a beautiful kind of passage about something that this class takes very seriously over the years, so you should hear. The source of a siyum, the source of finalizing a masechet, the source of having a little what to eat, what to drink, it says halva in here from 2,000 years ago. No. I'm just kidding. Ketav hayam shel Shlomo. One of the commentaries here on the Gemara says, Mikan Mekor Leminhag Yisrael, here is the very root of the custom of the Jewish people, La'asot Suda V'Simcha Be'et Siyum, to make a lot of simcha and have a nice what to eat at the closing out of learning a tractate, U'L'Shatef Behem Gamet Mishalosian, and you can even include those who didn't actually finish the tractate, that they can be there, say Kaddish, say Amen, and participate in the meal, and celebrate Shehare Abaye Losiem, by himself didn't finish reading it. He actually had these students who did. The Gamis min acherim shalosimu, and he also invited others who didn't even finish. Well, the fizik katab b'shabbat, and by the way, let me just make a comment. And why are they saying that? Because one shouldn't feel so bad in their heart to ever include anybody if they're learning, if they're coming to learn the last two words of the Masechet that you've learned over time, and they gain just a little bit by the fact that you started with the learning. You should feel great and wonderful that they came even to the last class. So this is the kind of tzniuta, this is the kind of modesty, this is the kind of celebration of limud and the celebration of rabbinic culture that Abaye himself did in his yeshiva, and when it was the younger colleagues even, who didn't know as much as the older colleagues, but might have something to say, he let them lead the siyum, he let them lead the teaching before that great meal and mashke, something to drink, and he said l'chaim with everybody, and he invited others to it, because he wanted to celebrate Talmud Torah in Israel because of the great nature of Torah learning and the culture that we've really begun according to the time that they're in, and continue here to this very day. Yeah, we're still going to learn next week. Please come to class.
Tomorrow morning?
Tomorrow morning I'm going to be here for davening. There's a group that wants